Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Our next guest is one of my favorites, and it's always a blast when he drops by. Dave Barry is a Pulitzer Prize-winning humor writer who wrote a weekly syndicated column for over 20 years. He's also the author of over two dozen books of nonfiction and over a dozen works of fiction. His most recent books were both New York Times bestsellers, the essay collection You Can Date Boys When You're 40, and the comic novel Insane City. His brand new book seeks to bring wisdom and joy to our lives, as do all of his books. It is called Live Right and Find Happiness, Although Beer is Much Faster. Life Lessons and Other Ravings from Dave Barry. It's a great pleasure to welcome Dave Barry back to the Roundtable this morning. Always nice to have you aboard, sir. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you with us. Do you think of yourself as a person that dispenses joy and wisdom?
No, I really don't. I think of myself as a guy who's basically got no useful skill in life. So he's, you know, I think of jokes, and I did it when I was in middle school. I did it when I was in high school. I did it when I was in college, and I managed to make a career out of it. And, I have sometimes been told in my life by various people that I've done them some good. You know, somebody will write me a very nice letter saying, Dave, you know, I was in a down place and, you know, I read your stuff and it helped me, or, you know, my dad and I didn't get along, but then we started reading your stuff together and we formed it. And I would say that's great, but my deep in my soul, I'm thinking, yeah, but even if I caused more pain in your life, I would still be doing this because it's the only thing I know how to do.
You write in the introduction to the book, I've had a long and rewarding career that consists of being paid to write pretty much any random idiot thing I want. You can put suspenders on a salamander, but it still won't make waffles.
Yeah, that was, I put that next sentence in just to prove I was paid to write that sentence, and it means absolutely nothing. And here you just read it on the radio. There's somebody out there who just tuned in and saying, wait a minute, why would you put suspenders on a salamander, and what does that got to do with waffles? That's the beauty of being a humor writer. So you can just go around dispensing just meaningless statements.
Do you dissect as to what's funny, of why that is just a funny sentence?
Well, yeah. I mean, when, you know, just take that as an example. At the time I wrote that, I just was trying to think of something truly ridiculous. And I probably played with 10 variations on the sentence. You know, probably at one point it might have been a weasel instead of a salamander.
Yes.
And I don't know when waffles came into play. But believe it or not, when other people are out doing productive, useful things with their lives, that's what I'm doing. I'm trying, what would be the best sentence to use here? You know, that's my job.
So a salamander more funny than gecko?
Oh, no, I didn't think, you know, maybe. Okay, next edition, you might...
No,
we might go
I still
gecko.
Think, no, I think you,
well, you don't hear salamander that often. The gecko's gotten kind of famous lately.
That's true. So, that's true. I don't want to be too cliche about it. When you put together a book like this, of course, many of your books have been collections of columns. This is all new stuff that you put together. So you sit down and say, okay, I'm writing a book, and this is I'm going to put these together. So you have, what, 10 pieces or so in here. So does that give you a new freedom?
Oh, yeah. And that's really the reason that I stopped writing my weekly newspaper column. I'd done it for over 20 years, and I enjoyed it. And I had, obviously, a lot of success with it, a good response from the newspaper world. But I just kind of felt constrained that, you know, every week, first of all, that I had to do something every week, you know, which I realize is not coal mining, but still had to come up with,
right.
And it had to be about 750 words. And it had to be in a format that would fit in a newspaper. Certain things you can do, certain things you can't do, certain subjects you can talk about, certain you can't, but mostly it was the length issue. And I just wanted to expand a little, write longer things, write things, that weren't necessarily newspaper material. And so that's when I started writing longer form essays.
Give us an example of what is not newspaper friendly.
Well, I mean, you can't write about sex too much. You can't use certain words you just obviously can't use in a newspaper.
Yeah.
And in general, newspapers are much pickier about what you're allowed to write about. When I wrote my column, it was in about 500 newspapers. And any given column I would write, there would be a couple of dozen papers that would have a problem with some part of it. You know, sometimes the editors would just be unbelievably, in my mind, oversensitive or hyper. And I, you know, that got a little tiring. And with a book, you know, you're writing for your specific audience when you write a book. You're not writing for everybody who reads the newspaper. They're buying my book with, you know, they know it's me.
Right.
And then I feel that I can cover more ground. I can be more personal. I can be more edgy, you know.
And what I know we've talked about this before, and I remember you saying that, you know, you don't think that somebody's going to get upset over a booger joke, but they do.
But they do. One thing I learned from my years as a newspaper columnist, there is no sentence you can write or no topic you can address that does not offend somebody somewhere. And I'm talking about like the most obvious joke you can make. If I would write, you know, ever since Abraham Lincoln invented the electric light, blah, 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 I would get 50 letters from people, or then later emails from people deeply offended that I didn't realize that the electric light wasn't invented by Abraham. And then they would tell me who did invent it. It would usually be somebody like Benjamin Franklin. I mean, they would have it wrong, but they would. The point is, they would take seriously whatever I wrote. And there's just always people ready to be offended. That's still true, but I think it's, if you're writing books, it's less like you're less likely to encounter those people.
Because do you realize, Dave Barry, how you could harm a salamander if you actually put suspenders on the salamander?
Yeah, to the Salamander Protective Association, which I'm sure is listening. I'm just kidding. You kids listening, do not put suspenders on your salamanders. Thank you. Belts are okay, however.
do not put suspenders on your salamander. Phrases that sound dirty but aren't.
That aren't. And you never find you thought you would find yourself saying on the, you know, anyway.
You know, I find it, we talk about the freedom, but so if, when you sit down and do you say there's, this book is going to be roughly about this. I want to do a very rough theme.
I do not say that.
Okay.
I never say that. Usually what I have is a list of things I would like to write about, but the only thing connecting them is they're all things that I would like to write about. The theme element comes in when I'm near the end of it and the editor, the publisher, gets it because they like to have a theme. They
sure.
Like they want to sell it and they want to promote it and they want to say, what is it? And I always say my ultimate book title would be Dave Barry, another Dave Barry book by Dave Barry. In other words, there's no real theme here. This is just stuff he thinks is funny. But they make me come up with one. And so, you know, I looked and in this case, the happiness theme sort of came up because not all, but most of the essays in some way deal with either happiness or unhappiness. There's some, I've written a couple of letters in this, which are both letters of advice to younger people. In one case, my daughter, and in one case, my grandson. So, you know, that's the topic, but it really isn't. It's just, you know, the title we've picked.
You write in here, looking back, I think my parents had more fun than I did.
Yeah, this essay has gotten more attention than anything else in this book so far. And it's an insight I had. Insight is maybe too strong a term, but it's something I thought of watching the TV show Mad Men, which I like a lot. But it's set in, Mad Men is set in an era when I grew up. It's set in the 60s. Really, I think starts in the early 60s. I grew up in Armonk, New York, suburb of New York City. I was born in 47, grew up in the 50s and 60s there. I lived in a Mad Men community. The dads, including my dad, rode the train to New York City. The moms, for the most part, stay home, raise the kids, and so on. And it was the suburbs, but it was the New York City suburbs. Friends of my parents were advertising executives, like the Mad Men thing. And in the TV show Mad Men, the characters drink and smoke a lot, and they're all unhappy. And the part that I connected with was they drank and smoked a lot. So did my parents and their friends. I mean, they did. It was a different world, and they ate gluten also. They didn't care. No. They didn't care about a lot of stuff. But what really struck me was, whereas in Mad Men, the characters were kind of gloomy, my parents had fun. And I'm talking about big-time fun after they became parents. Like my generation, the baby boomers, I think we had fun too. But then when we became parents, we got pretty serious about parenting and about, which is a verb I think we invented. You know, my parents didn't parent. They were parents. And about, you know, our job became raising our kids right and protecting them from anything bad and removing obstacles from their paths and ensuring that they were totally safe and happy and whatever, all the hovering things that we do. My parents didn't do that. They were good parents. They loved us, but they were much more able to just say, hey, we're also still people and we're going to have some fun. And on the weekends, my parents would have these big parties. They did, or somebody else did, it sort of rotated around the community, where they would play charades, they would dance, they would put on skits, they would have scavenger hunts, you know, and they would, of course, drink a lot and, you know, and then drive, which is bad. I mean, it's bad, but that's what they did back then. And they partied. I mean, they partied hard. I have an anecdote in there one morning after the party was at our house, and we always loved it. My sister and brothers and I loved it when the party was. We'd sneak out and watch the smoke-filled room where all the grown-ups were getting crazy. The next morning, you know, the house is quiet. And my brother Phil comes into my bedroom and goes, "There's two giant bees in the living room." And I go, and I thought he meant the insect. Giant bees. I go in the living room, and there are two letter bees made of wood, maybe 4 feet high, which had been stolen from the IBM Corporation sign. Armonk was then being had been chosen as the world headquarters of IBM, which was building this giant compound. And they had a sign outside with these giant golden letters, IBM. And apparently my parents had had a scavenger hunt in their party. And one of the things on a scavenger hunt was to get the bees from the IBM site.
And they got them.
They got them. And we're talking about, like, we're not talking about criminals here. These were stockbrokers and lawyers and, you know, successful executives in their 40s. Went out and stole a piece of the IBM sign and brought it home to the party. That kind of stuff really went on back then. And I don't think it goes on anymore.
It's funny because I remember hearing stories of my parents, and I was the youngest of five kids, but they would tell me about these times where they would have parties, they'd have a bunch of people over, just as you said, have a bunch of people over, they'd smoke, get a little lit, drink, and like put on a new Bob Newhart album. And that big night.
Yeah, or play charades. They did innocent, silly fun they did.
So when did that change in then when we grew up of how we deal with our kids and all of that stopped?
Because I think I'll take full blame, the baby boomer generation takes itself pretty seriously. We invented natural childbirth. Like, nobody had ever had a baby until the baby boomers and we took it seriously, and we're gonna have a new way and do it the right way. And then when we're gonna be parents, by God, we're gonna be the best parents ever.
Yeah.
And we're gonna have, you know, we're gonna focus on our kids, and my parents' generation just didn't take themselves that seriously, I don't think. And they didn't take they didn't worry as much about stuff. They were just more capable of letting it go. At the end of the week, they worked hard. These are, for the most part, people who have been through the Depression and World War II. They'd had some real troubles, but now they had it pretty good, and they were going to enjoy themselves. And I just think they were more capable of that somehow than we ended up being. If we do that kind of thing now, like have a big charades party, we do it kind of ironically or a little bit embarrassed we're a little silly. And they didn't feel silly. That was like, hey, we're going to have some fun here.
Dave Barry is our guest. The new book is Live Right and Find Happiness, although beer is much faster. It's interesting to me, too, because I found this, I mean, not to get overly psychological, but in this idea of, as you say, your generation of baby boomers, but I also think it's why you've had a career, right? I mean, that people want to have that moment where they can poke fun at the seriousness of what they have done.
Yeah, basically my whole career has come down to making fun of my generation. the real breakthrough moment for me in my career was a piece I wrote in 1980 about natural childbirth. And it was actually published in 1981 in the Philadelphia Inquirer. But it was just what I was saying earlier, where you know, the previous generations just had babies, as that had been done for millions of years. And it wasn't considered a particularly impressive achievement. People did it. It was a special thing, but people did it. And the baby boomers, you know, came up with this whole idea of, you had to go to classes, you had to learn how to breathe in a certain way, we're going to transform it. And I wrote an essay kind of in the end mocking that, saying in the end it comes down to the woman going, just the way it always did. And none of this stuff worked. You know, we had the babies. And that became hugely popular with baby boomer editors who put it in the newspapers all around. And that's really how I got syndicated. And that's sort of been my career, is like, as we became parents, talking about the weirdness of baby boomer parents. And then now baby boomers is getting old.
And much of your, I mean, you've written books about turning 40 and turning 50. I mean, that aging process is something you chronicle and like to chronicle.
Yeah, as if no one else ever did it before.
You have a story in the book about you and your friend Ridley Pearson going to Russia. And one of the things, it's a great story, but I had no idea that we had a U.S. State Department American Writers Series program.
Yeah, Ridley Pearson, who's a wonderful thriller writer and a good friend, he's in a band with me. He and I co-wrote some young adult fiction books, the Peter and the Starcatcher series. And the State Department, as you say, has a program where they send American writers to Russia to improve relations between the two countries. So they sent Ridley and me in September, and we see how that's worked.
You've done fine work there, Mr. Barry. You should be very proud.
It was interesting. It was kind of fun. I enjoyed it. The people we dealt with were really pretty nice. There were a couple of times when there was an undercurrent of hostility. The Russian people do not – they're being fed daily, all day long, a strong anti-American message from the Putin government. But for the most part, we did fine over there. I do recommend that if this is my one major tip, don't anybody, if you go to Russia, don't eat the Mexican food. I had a chimichanga one night. I think it was a weaponized chimichanga. Didn't go well. Is all. I'm not going to get too explicit here.
Yeah.
Just don't eat the Mexican food in Russia.
You say the trip sort of went downhill.
Downhill, right? Is one way to put it. Down the toilet, you could say, is another way.
Do you feel when you come back from a trip like that you've accomplished something?
No, I can honestly say
the American way.
I liked the people over there. I had this conversation where we did mostly either we're talking to audiences that spoke some English or we had to go through interpreters with us the whole time. But I asked them always, what are your stereotyped images of us? And what do you think our stereotyped images of you are? And theirs of us were always that we are like very consumer oriented. We just like to sit in front of our big screen TVs and we don't care about the rest of the world, which of course is highly accurate. and I said, well, what do you think we think of you? And they said that they just drink all the time and that they are a bunch of gangsters, which I guess is also what we think. I didn't find a whole lot of gangsters over there. There was some drinking going on, I will say.
Yeah. And did you talk to writers too?
Yeah, we had an interesting meeting with it's called the Russian Writers Union, which is really just an arm of the government. And it was the tensest discussion we had. They were the most overtly political people there. And, they just didn't like our system. Their system is the government pays them and they distribute the money to writers. And so writers who are writing acceptable, approved themes get the money to write books. And our system, of course, is anybody who can, that the publisher thinks will sell, can write a book. It doesn't have to be a good book. It can be 50 Shades of Grey. They don't care. Basically the discussion was, we think they think our system produces a lot of crap books. And we think their system produces a lot of books nobody's ever going to read because they are government approved. Probably we're both right. That was the most close to just like head-to-head, we don't like you, you don't like us kind of discussion we had. I mean, they were cordial enough, but it was very clear they didn't think much of us as writers. A couple of hacks from America.
Yeah. Just because you brought it up, and it fascinates me. But when you see somebody like E.L. James have such great success with a book like 50 Shades of Grey, do you think to yourself, well, what the hell is happening with the American people? Or do you think, well, good for her?
I'll be honest, more good for her. I'm past the stage. I've been in the book business for more than 30 years now.
Yeah.
And like, if you think that that there should be a correlation between the quality of the book and the sales of the book, then you're just always going to be an unhappy person because a lot of this stuff, there was a time, there really was in America, but like 50 years ago, when literary books would hit the bestseller list regularly. You had people like Ernest Hemingway writing them, That time has passed, and it's been passed for a long time, and a lot of just, crud gets on the Times, and that's the way it is. The thing for me, is that, at least somebody's reading, which
that's a good thing.
I'll take it. And also, in my last book, which is also a collection of essays, One of the essays, which was very well received, was an essay making fun of 50 Shades of Grey. I mean, I read it. I was one of the only guys I know who read the book. I found it hilarious. I'll be honest. If you read it as a book of humor, it's hilarious.
Very funny.
I wrote an essay about it, and you know, the essay was quite popular, you know. So it didn't sell as many as that book didn't sell anywhere, you know, like a billionth as many as she sold, but you know, didn't hurt me.
Now, I may be all wrong on this, but if you put out, I mentioned in the introduction, you have the two most recent books, both were bestsellers, but you have the book of essays and then you have the novel. Does the novel not sell as well as the book of essays?
Oh, I honestly do not know the answer to that question. Yeah. If I had to guess, I would say that the novel probably sold more, but to get on the bestseller list as a novelist, I think you have to sell quite a bit more than it's in a nonfiction. You know, they break it down by, this is getting kind of inside baseball, but I don't think, I could be completely wrong, but I think fiction sells more than nonfiction, and so.
It fascinates me because I think when I read your novels, whether it be Insane City or Big Trouble, I mean, they're really, it seems to me that you're, Not to put down what you do normally, but this is like really good fiction telling and really good literary writing.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoy writing novels, and it's sort of, I have to wait till I have a story in my mind that I want to tell. But and it's harder for me to write a novel than to write humor essays. I mean, I've been writing humor essays all my life. I've only written three adult novels, and. But I do enjoy doing it, and I was quite proud of the last one, Insane City. I had to tell you a story about Big Trouble, which was my first novel. On this trip to Russia, near the end of the trip, we were in St. Petersburg, and they invited us to do a thing called movie night at the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg, which is when the U.S. government invites Russians in, just regular Russian citizens, anybody can come. To watch an American movie, mm-hmm. and they usually show classics. But when I was there with Ridley, they wanted to show Big Trouble, which was a movie made based on my book called Big Trouble. And they said, can you bring a copy of it over with you? And would you be willing to introduce it and answer questions afterward? And I said, sure. I didn't think about it. So I get over there. I do all these events with Ridley where every single event I ask him, what do you think our stereotypical views of you are? Every single one they say, gangsters, gangsters. You think we're gangsters. You know, they don't really resent that. So then we got to show the movie. It's movie night. We're going to show Big Trouble. And I haven't seen it in a couple of years, so I'm quickly reviewing the plot in my mind. I remember, hey, there's two Russians in it. They're gangsters. So I got to get up in front of an audience of Russians. And introduce my book in which the only Russian characters are gangsters. And that was difficult. And I had to point out to them, because they all gave me this look when I said, and there are Russians in it. They're gangsters, but they're much smarter than the American gangsters. American gangsters are all idiots. Yours are intelligent.
Very smart gangsters. Yeah. And that was, and I know, I think you've told the story on the air before, but I love it. I don't love it. It's a horrible story, but because that was all the book comes out, it's great. Then the movie comes out, and then it's supposed to come out September 11th.
It's actually September 12th was the day it was supposed to come out. The day after 9/11, this was a story that had the plot revolved around two morons who get hold of a suitcase nuke from the Russian gangsters who sell it to them, and they end up on a plane with the suitcase nuke. That blows up, but it doesn't. It only kills a bad guy. Anyway, it's a madcap comedy, and it was made into this movie. They spent millions of dollars making this movie, and yes, it was supposed to come out the day after 9/11. Well, of course, it wasn't going to come out. I mean, you're not going to have a madcap plot about a bomb going off on a plane the day after 9/11. So that kind of totally sabotaged that movie, unfortunately.
It as Stan Freberg used to say, it's. You don't release these things. Sometimes they just have to escape.
Yeah, that's what happened. They released it later on very quietly.
And a good movie, though.
It's a good movie, and it actually had a a long life on cable. And it has sort of a little bit of a cult following to this day. But yeah, that was one of the many, 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 and I'm certainly putting it way down the list of bad things that resulted from 9/11. That was one of them.
Let's, as we wrap up, what do you see that you still would like to accomplish? You've done a lot. You've done many different things, certainly many facets to your career. Is there anything still?
Besides the bodybuilding gold medal,
well,
no.
Of course, that.
I'm still striving. No, you know, I don't really have. I feel I'm one of the most fortunate people ever, I know. Everything that has happened to me pretty much is more than I would have ever hoped for to begin with. My, you know, I've had a great life, great career, and it's really been fun. You know, I've never been a particularly ambitious person. I'm always like, wow, this is great. What I get to do for a living is really great. I got to go to Russia. You know why? I don't know. I got to go though, and it was fun. It was interesting. I'm on this show with you. I mean, I just kind of enjoy it. I don't always think now I need to. I don't usually think that way. So it sort prevents of disappointment.
Like it sort of sounds like you're giving up, though.
No. It's the secret to happiness. Have no ambition whatsoever.
Because you look at you've done well, of course, humor columns, and well, those really aren't even around anymore. But you conquered that world. You have successful books, best-selling novels. The dabble in the film world, dabble into Broadway, even into kids' literature. So, I mean,
so what do you want me to do now?
Exactly.
What do you want from me?
There's nothing out there. You say, oh, okay, maybe I'd like to do
that. No, but all that stuff sort of, that's all been good. It's like not, you know, I didn't say, God, I have to get a Broadway play. And I ended up with one. It was one, I mean, you know, I co-wrote the book it was based on.
Yeah.
But, you know, that to me, it's better than always thinking you should have X and not getting it. I like it's much better when you don't expect much and then you get it.
I didn't even mention the sitcom.
Yeah.
The new book, Live Right and Find Happiness, Although Beer is Much Faster, Life Lessons and Other Ravings from Dave Barry. The book is published by Putnam. Dave Barry, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Best of luck. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Live Right and Find Happiness, Although Beer is Much Faster. It's published by Putnam, by Dave Barry. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.